Hello, and welcome to another Sports Next Door podcast. My name is Owen. Today is Thursday, March 7th, and I'm joined, as I always am, by my neighbor Max. How's it going, my friend?
I'm doing well. Been a little minute, half a week later, because you were in Arizona. Curious how that was.
It was warm. Enjoyed that. However, the 2.5 hours I was probably outside over the 3 and a bit days that I was there. Really, really cool facility in Mesa, Arizona. Formerly Legacy Park, now Arizona Athletic Grounds. Max's place has 28 turf fields, 8 ball diamonds, 3 indoor facilities that contain endless basketball and volleyball courts. Like, just a monster of a facility. And yeah, cool to go check it out. If anyone watches Fox News Arizona, I might be in the background of a segment. Hey. Played pickleball for the first time ever.
Boo.
Yeah, it was fun. It was fun. I know. I didn't want to say it was fun, but it really was. I played singles with my boss, and we had a blast. And
did you guys do like a bike race on training wheels while you were at it, or like play some t-ball too while you were there?
Well, you can say all you want, but until you try it, you won't understand it. I mean, I do still prefer tennis. I've only played pickleball once, but I can see the appeal of how accessible it is as a sport.
Yeah, if you're over 70.
Well, that's doubles, but I felt like in the singles, I was moving around quite a bit. Certainly as much as when I play against you.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah. Other first for me on the trip, Topgolf. First time ever participating in Topgolf, and I am a horrendous golfer. It probably gone 4 times in my life, and probably hit the most number of straight balls that I have in my life, which was pretty cool. But I've got this nasty little blister that you probably can't see on the screen that well.
So, I don't know what Topgolf is.
Oh, wow. This is exciting. Yeah. Okay. Bad podcasting, but I'm going to pull it up images on Google, because I feel like most of our demographic knows Topgolf. It's a driving range that's interactive. So you gotta let me share my screen here. There's like 3 decks with tees all the way along. So there's probably like 10, 15 booths per floor. And then you hit out into this like massive driving range that's enclosed by cages. And then there's holes, pits in the ground, selectively set up, and then you can play games, because they track your swing, they track the ball speed and how far you're hitting it. Wow. So like me and my boss played Angry Birds, where it like superimposes a castle onto the field on the screen next to you, and so you just have to aim where you're shooting, and then it's going to track your ball as the bird. And and then we did like the generic original version is you just try to get as many points as you can. So landing it in the holes or landing it in the like larger areas. So let me just pull it up, Max, so you can see it here.
Okay. So it's kind of just like a flat green driving range, but then there's these circles in the middle. Yep. And it's kind of like, I don't know, something you'd see at an arcade.
Yeah, and then you got pub food, drinks, and then the interactive games, and there's a bar inside for when you're done. It's a blast.
Huh.
Yeah. So we're going to have to go out sometime.
Yeah, well, first to the tennis court, and then we can see. But from what you've talked about golf, I actually wouldn't mind trying my hand at that one in our lifelong gauntlet of games.
Yes, absolutely. Olympics. So yeah, those were two highlights for sure. I did not do any physical activity beyond those things. Ate a lot of good food, sat in a lot of meetings and did a lot of work, but good little trip. I'm trying to recover from it now, and good to take 40 minutes out of my work day to chat with you.
Out of your work day, it's 8 p.m. I hope you weren't working before and after this.
Yikes. Maybe not after.
Yikes. Okay, on that note, we have not a lot of in-depth content for any one sport, but I think a lot of different things we're going to try and touch on here today. The biggest event happening, the NHL trade deadline, less than 24 hours away from completing. And we've had plenty of activity on the 6th and 7th, with still some potential activity to come on the 8th. That is tomorrow, the day of the deadline, aka stuff that will have happened by the time this podcast is out, but we can really only do so much for scheduling. Looking through the list of trades, nothing really blew my head off. Oh, the Hanifin one to the Golden Knights, probably the biggest name, the biggest splash. But nonetheless, I think when you look at the list, I felt it was pretty clear to me which GMs and teams consider themselves buyers and contenders this season, and which are bowing out as sellers.
Yeah, and there's always that clear divide that ends up happening during the trade deadline, but especially this season felt like some teams towards the middle and bottom of the pack didn't feel like they were sellers. Nashville Predators were a team that kind of wavered back and forth. They ended up being buyers.
They said they consider themselves both this trade deadline. Yeah.
Well, and after they got their U2 concert canceled, I think they've won seven in a row since then. So I guess
I
that
hear
worked.
About that.
You got to go back and read that. Quite the story. But like Calgary Flames said they were going to buy, which made no sense. In the end, they end up selling, right? Chris Tanev to the Dallas Stars is a great pickup for them. And yeah, a couple of those other teams hanging around the periphery haven't been super. Definitely the teams towards the top and the bottom of the league made some deals today. And that's kind of where we want to jump in. And really the biggest thing to talk about are those three Western teams that are trying to separate themselves as the cream of the crop in that conference and are probably the top three favorites when you're thinking Stanley Cup right now. And that would be the Golden Knights, like you mentioned. The meme is the dude holding the gun to the back of someone's head, and that's team one interested in player. Then there's that other person a couple rows pews back in the church with a gun on that person, team two. And then it's Vegas, the sniper up in the top row of the church that just has their eye trained on that second gunman. And whenever they enter a conversation, it usually ends with them getting that player. They are so good at swinging deals and asset management. They had their first, second, and third round picks for the next 2 years in the cupboard to spend. And so them going out and getting Hanifin is such a great swing for them to bolster an already strong defensive core, and to give up a first, a third, and a prospect. I mean, for that, they probably are going to have a great shot at re-signing him because they wanted to go somewhere American. It feels like another fantastic swing by the defending champs.
It's good to be good feeling when you can be a contender, throw your first out, and just get the type of caliber player that draft pick turns into in most best case scenarios, and have the confidence that you're going to be able to re-sign him because you have a successful hockey winning program and being the defending Stanley Cup champs, just cherry on the top. A bit of a quiet regular season, but it would not surprise me at all to see this team remind everyone how good they were last playoffs as soon as they kick off again this year.
I mean, that's the thing. There's a couple GMs in this league. Like, if Kelly McCrimmon's calling me, I shouldn't answer that phone. But I mean, if you're the Flames here, like, he had to go. So
yeah,
you do get a pretty good haul for him. In addition to Tanev, and you can start retooling around some of your younger guys.
I mean, you look just not very far either way at the Oilers and the Canucks as two teams that have been in serious trouble and had a lot of negative headlines for a window of time in the last 2 years, who have both completely 180'd that. The Oilers doing a bit of buying here close to the deadline, the Canucks having done most of their purchasing already. But just to like the Canucks were such a joke last year. The Oilers looked like they weren't even going to come close to the playoffs. And I don't frankly know what either team did other than firing their head coach. Well, that's it. I guess they both fired their head coach and kind of turned it around. But yeah, I was trying to make a point about hockey being a sport where teams can turn around quickly, and also cycle that into a fluid segue asking your thoughts on the Oilers pickups, but I couldn't really smooth that one out. Yeah. So we'll just roughly clunk into that.
So another two teams involved in this trade that are on opposite ends of the spectrum, like Calgary and like Vegas. The Oilers nibbled around the edges here on their trades. Adam Henrique, Sam Carrick, right? Depth forward, depth defenseman for a seventh. And then they also spent a first, likely to get some retention on both of those players. So, I mean, Adam Henrique, great contributor. Sam Carrick is going to play in their lineup. I don't think any of them move the needle in a massive way, but if they raise the floor of your team, right, that's all you can ask for when you got guys like Connor and Leon.
Yeah.
And then they go ahead and just take another shot on an available defenseman from another wallowing team that I wish I had gone to see when I was in Arizona. Mm. The Coyotes give up, I think it was a fourth round pick here for Troy Stetcher. Seventh. Yeah, so for Troy Stetcher and a seventh, they give up a fourth, and the Oilers make a move there to add a couple of defensemen, which were in high priority here around the trade deadline, right? There was obviously Hanifin was the biggest name there, but everyone's always looking for a defenseman to add, and the prices were high, and that's why we saw a team like the Leafs have to spend a third and a fifth round pick to get Joel Edmondson. So yeah. Things were pricey at the deadline. I think the Oilers did a decent job adding. I mean, when you have Connor McDavid, all draft capital is essentially obsolete for the next 5-7 years still. So why bother hanging on to some of that when you can turn around into players who are going to service your lineup? I'm all on board with the moves there. And then the last team we really have to talk about out of these three major contenders is the Colorado Avalanche, who were extremely active today, acquiring Yakov Trenin, also acquiring Brandon Duhame from Minnesota Wild, a nice defensive pickup to add to their bunch, and also acquiring up-and-coming defenseman Sean Walker for a first and getting off of Ryan Johansson's deal, which freed up some cap flexibility naturally. For rumors that we might get into here in a second, but acquiring Sean Walker gave him a great defenseman, young prospect, and it made Bowen Byram expendable. And yeah, they go and turn him into Casey Mittelstadt, which he is a phenomenal forward for Buffalo, does all the little things right, is going to provide them some more punch in that middle six group, which is what they've needed because they've been a one-line team. And if rumors are believed to be true, they are sniffing around the possibility of creating a three-headed monster down the middle with Mittelstadt, MacKinnon, and one Sidney Crosby.
The last I heard these rumors, you've mentioned them a couple times off the pod today, like the Penguins management was, maybe we don't make it this playoffs, everyone but Crosby, Malkin, Letang expendable right now. You've teased this so many times. Has something officially changed? Just something of something in the water?
I think it was the combination of draft or cap clearance and the rumors having picked up more recently in the last 2 weeks. I don't think it's going to come to pass, but goodness gracious, would that be exciting?
Yeah, it's so hard to fathom Sidney Crosby on any team that isn't the Pittsburgh Penguins until I hear from a reputable source that's in the water. I'm not going to spend too much time thinking about it. That's the sort of shit we did in NHL 09 with trade, forced trade turned on. Jake Guentzel, the player the Penguins are looking to move, with a really sticky limbo situation where Crosby still continuing the trend where he has never had a season in his life where he has produced at less than point per game into his mid late 30s and still doing that. If you're Penguins management, you still hope to get something to make another push, but their time is running out and they're not narrowing the gap. Gensel, an unrestricted free agent this season. I think the Penguins have always been a bit cursed with Crosby, and this is something we've experienced a bit as Leafs fans, where he just makes the guys around him so dang good that those guys then just want to get paid for what they're doing, and how much their play is being elevated by being one next to one of the greatest to ever do it, like, is a tricky thing to wager or factor into a wage discussion. But it's a conversation the Penguins not really looking forward to. And with Penguin and Malkin in the twilight of their career, they're certainly not looking to spend big or spend long term. So do you get rid of the player who's been helpful and just make one more acquiescence to the fact that you're probably not making the playoffs this season? The fact that he's injured just hampers the whole thing even more, because that makes him that less appealing an asset, but that much less helpful for you to try and make that final playoff push. So as we're heading into the trade deadline tomorrow, which again will be basically over by the time anyone listens to this podcast, Jake Gensel, probably the biggest name that's flying around the market right now that could get moved.
Besides Sid. Yeah, no, definitely interesting to see what Kyle Dubas will do there. Hasn't signaled one way or the other yet on which way he wants this team to go, but he's going to have to make that choice sooner rather than later. And you can't stay tied to the older core four. Rangers add Alex Wenberg. Panthers add Vladimir Tarasenko and a couple of depth pickups for both of those teams. I'm sure they'll be in on whoever's left here at the trade deadline. We'll keep a close eye on it. But that will do it for talking hockey for now. And we've got a little bit of combat corner.
I think I've touched on this once or twice, but with the UFC pay-per-view event coming up this weekend, I just wanted to say one more time, Marlon Vera does not deserve a title shot against Sean O'Malley, and it's so silly that this is happening just for the rematch, just because they think it's going to sell because O'Malley lost to him, and O'Malley's a very egotistical, like a kind of in the McGregor vein, just calling for the rematch ever since he lost. And more importantly, he's dodging two harder fights against two guys who deserve the title shot more. Mirab Dvalshy, I know I'm butchering that, but just the Georgian power cardio BPO wrestler, who's on a crazy winning streak and has just been making the best guys in the division look helpless. And Corey Sandhagen, who literally beat Marlon Vera less than a year ago, incredibly decisively, has no fight booked. And I just didn't want to let this podcast right before pass without saying it's really, really silly. An example of UFC title matchmaking at the worst level. That's all.
Then we'll move into basketball storylines, where we had a couple of key games this past weekend. Coming off their drubbing of the Golden State Warriors, the Celtics were winners of 11 straight and looked to be headed to a 12th before blowing a 22-point lead to the Cleveland Cavaliers in the fourth quarter on Tuesday evening, led by none other than Dean Wade, the second most famous D Wade in Cleveland Cavaliers favorite history, even though the other one was washed by the time he was there. And yeah, those Cavaliers, man, Darius Garland, really fun. They do it without Donovan Mitchell. And I think Evan Mobley actually was out with a sprained ankle. So it's really weird that Cleveland, it feels like, actually operates it's the best version of themselves when it is one of the guards and Jared Allen. So they have something to figure out here as they get down the stretch on how they want to manipulate those rotations. But the Celtics go cold, and it just gives their fans some pause Because they're still, what, 43 and 18 on the season? Just far and away the best team in the league in all facets, in all metrics. But they have these games that make you concerned as a Boston fan.
But they're 48 and 13.
Oh, I flipped the flipped the second digit in those records. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, so it's there's just a couple of these games that make you nervous as a Celtics fan. And we're in for such a treat tonight as they head to Denver to take on the Nuggets in a potential finals preview, as the Nuggets are also coming off of a stinging loss of their own, losing in Phoenix to the Suns, coming back themselves from a double-digit deficit. Jamal Murray with the late jumper, but then Kevin Durant nails a three right in Aaron Gordon's face, forces overtime, and both Beal and Durant get hot while the Nuggets can't convert on their end, and Phoenix pulls out that win in overtime, gives a potential interesting look into what that series could look like. But I don't know if I can take that all the way for granted. The Nuggets at the end of a road trip and coming back home where they play exceptionally well. I think we're going to get the best effort from both of these teams. This game's going to mean something. So everyone make sure you dial your televisions in tonight.
Yeah, there was a trend like 20, 30 games into the season, I want to say, where someone pointed out the Nuggets were like consistently beating the bottom ranked teams and like really struggling like below 500 against like the top five above 500 type teams. I think they've turned that around a little midway into the season, but just there have been a lot of those like I know the Thunder have had their number all season, but just a lot of like circle your calendar for matchups for the Nuggets that they've performed below on. And I think there have been like several moments this season with the Clippers and the Bucks where we've been like, these teams are screwed because of this pattern that's been going on, and there's like some conventional wisdom you're kind of ignoring there. And so mate, like the Nuggets have just been too good for too long to like assume that continues into the playoffs, but it's hard to not overemphasize the importance of being the defending champs while not underestimating the regular season coast and find that balance.
Oh yeah, like they definitely don't have their foot all the way on the gas, and you're usually getting each team's best effort every night when you're the defending champs. So it's just more likely that you're going to see that regression. Only the truly, truly great teams in the history of basketball will go back the next year and be the one seed after winning a title. And there's plenty of those to choose from in the last 20, 25 years, right? We got like your early 2000s Lakers. You got your mid 2000s Celtics and Lakers. You got your early 2010s Miami Heat. Of course, the Golden State Warriors and the Cleveland Cavs. And then most recently, the Milwaukee Bucks, after winning their title, continue to be a dominant force. But it's becoming less common in the high level of parity in the league that you're going to see a team put as much emphasis on that one seed, just as what we've seen, right? Like, we could have the Lakers Thunder in this first round, and the Lakers dominated the Thunder with size this past weekend, which was another interesting result.
They've had
LeBron
a couple
at 40K
of those.
Too.
Yeah, LeBron, they beat the Clippers. They beat the Nuggets. I think they beat the Nuggets.
No, they lost.
Okay, they beat the Clippers, the Thunder. Man, like, I feel like we're going to say it every podcast now till the playoffs and then in our playoff preview. But the West playoffs are just going to be...
I was telling my dad, I was like, if you have to pick one sport here, just pick the Western Conference playoffs at the NBA. Should be thrilling. We'll keep on the NBA here as we move along, but I think we'll finish up with tennis talk, and then I am going to show Max the new Formula One track proposed in Saudi Arabia.
I was just checking my notes before I realized there were no notes. But Indian Wells has kicked off. I think we're in day one, day two, the round of 128. Of course, 96 players competing on both the ATP and WTA side. So hard to really do justice to enough of the players and giving a preview, and almost certainly it will be some name I don't get to that makes some big splash in storylines. And if you've been listening to this podcast for the last 2 months, you should know who the best four players on both the men's and women's side of the tour in this moment are. So here's just some reminders about what this tournament means for each of them. Starting on the men's, those four in order would be Novak Djokovic, Carlos Alcaraz, Jannik Sinner, and Daniil Medvedev. Novak Djokovic, number one in the world. Coming off a rough Australian Open, this Indian Wells tournament that he hasn't played in for years is on one hand just a chance to further consolidate and bolster that number one spot in the rankings. But I think more than that, at this point in his career, when his tennis appearances are so limited, every tournament is a chance for him to stamp his dominance further onto the sport and onto the minds of the rest of the tour so that he can continue doing this for as long as he hopes to. And after an Australian Open where he looked shaky in several matches, none more than that Jannik Sinner final, where it's not clear if whatever was wrong with him all tournament was more wrong with him. That was a semifinal where Sinner made it clear, like, it doesn't matter if something's wrong with you, something's not wrong with you. I'm playing at a level where you need your absolute best just to stay on the court with me. And Djokovic was so far from that day. So for that reason, like, my dream matchup there on opposite sides of the draw would be Sinner versus Djokovic. To get there, you'd love to see a Sinner-Alcaraz semifinal. Alcaraz, the defending champion at this tournament, he twisted his ankle in Rio the other week. He was able to play the Netflix slam and win the Netflix slam against Rafa. Quick bravo for Carlos on that. Three-time slam champion, Carlos Alcaraz. But defending champion here, I think he could lose that number two spot to Sinner, depending how it all shakes out. So eyes on Alcaraz for the ankle. Defending champion, I would love to see that Sinner semifinal. It's always fireworks when they play. Sinner has been the best player in the world the two tournaments he has played in 2024 so far. So just looking to see if he can continue that dominance here on a new continent and new hard court surface. And speaking of surfaces, it's fitting to bring in Daniil Medvedev here. He very famously, or fairly somewhat famously in very nerdy circles, was very upset about the courts and the state of the courts last year, despite making it all the way to the finals. It seems to often be a narrative at Indian Wells, so it'll be something to check in on as the tournament progresses. But finalist points being defended by Medvedev. He got bounced in the semifinals of Dubai in his first outing since the Australian Open. So eyes on him as well. Other wildcard names would be Andre Rublev, five in the world, who was getting talked about for the wrong reasons after his disqualification last week. Alex Zverev, who I would say this tournament, the fourth round match against Medvedev, was the first time he showed flashes that he was coming back. Alex de Minaur successfully defended his title in Acapulco, Mexico. And Hugo Humbert from France received a career-high ranking this week based off of his ATP Dubai 500 win, which was his second win in 2024. So he's been heating up and has never been ranked higher in the world, so certainly a name to keep an eye on. Last bit of men's news is that the aforementioned Rafael Nadal will not be competing in Indian Wells, unfortunately, pulling out at the very last minute. So now we have to wait until clay season, where we hope to see Rafa. And with another pullout, the questions just pile up even further. Like, is this it? Did it end before we even knew it was over? But just at the same time, being the competitor that he is, people think he just only wants to play. if he can win and wants to give himself his best chance at winning. And he knows that the clay is where he can do the most winning, so that he's really just trying to dot all his I's, cross all his T's, and make sure things are as perfect as possible. I'm holding out hope that he's got several clay seasons left in him, even if he just stops playing the hard court altogether. It would be hilarious to see how long he could keep it going for, just like that. On the women's side, quickly, same thing. You know the top four. I'd say they're a lot less established so far in their early careers than on the men's side. That might be debatable, but anyway, what is definitely established is Iga Świątek is the number one women's player in the world. Opposite her will be Arina Sabalenka, who I'm pretty sure won this tournament last year. Iga is hotter than Arnia this last month, though Arnia looked really, really, really good defending her points in Australia. So she'll see if she can find that form again. Then rounding out the top four in Iga's half of the draw will be Elena Rybakina. And on Arnia's side will be Coco Gauff. I jinxed it last Masters, so just crossing the fingers and hoping to see some of these four ladies play. It is really electric tennis almost every time any of them meet, though I would say the upsets and the chance of a name I haven't mentioned lifting the cup much likelier on the women's side just by the nature of the game. We're recording this on a Thursday. We might be updating on a Monday, so I won't get too much into the matches. But looking forward to seeing the tournament play out. And I've given you 7 minutes.
Well, that's fine, because we're not going to do a great job podcasting. Instead, I'm going to show you this.
Is this a Mario Kart map?
Essentially.
Oh, my God.
So folks, this, if you have not seen the photos, I encourage you to look up Qiddiya City. In Saudi Arabia. This city is not yet finished construction itself, but will be home to the most absurd racing track I have ever seen in my life.
This is AI generating real life Mario Kart is what we're looking at on the camera, folks.
So there's a water park with the city located, and then the track kind of is on the outskirts of the city right before the desert. And it is going to be the longest track in Formula One history at about 7 kilometers. There's pools where you can watch the race in. And it is going to have a 108 meter tall ramp, where turn one happens 12 stories above ground level in a truly rainbow road format of Formula One. And this sport, which is so incredibly corrupt and driven by money, there's got to be some entertaining things that come out of that. And I don't support the F1 in any way in terms of their social and political views, but I will be watching this race.
Yeah, the Saudis have been really, really good at throwing lots of money at athletes in their sports washing attempts so far. I don't know a lot about the country and the state, but this is some next level engineering that they're looking to pull off. I saw 2030 written in the article. I am going to have to say I'll believe it when I see it on this. It's one thing to dream this up, but I don't know. I think also the way their golf league just hasn't, I haven't heard a single person talk about watching a single golf event that they've put on, even though they got all these athletes. I don't know what's going on with their football league. Fights happen. They can make fights happen. And I might circle back to that in a second. But this is a really cool AI picture, and I'm sure they have the money to drip, but hiring the right people to make this happen. I mean, less red tape than if you wanted to do that here, but that is some next level futuristic stuff.
A man can dream. A man can dream. Final notes here. TFC, good this year. Looking forward to watching a game when I'm in Toronto this summer. Max, final notes.
Joshua versus Ngannou boxing tomorrow. Forgot to touch on that in Combat Corner. But after Ngannou made a really competitive and landed more damage against Tyson Fury, no one can look past him, especially with it not being entirely clear where exactly Anthony Joshua is at in his boxing career. So just this fantastic thing where this MMA man of dreams and nightmares continues this story-like career, taking on a guy who was pretty unanimously considered one of the best boxers in the world and one of the most dangerous men in the ring on the planet for many, many years, who's still within like a healthy range of his age. Like, this isn't a 38-year-old guy Ngannou is taking on, I don't think. And I think there's some implications for the winner, but just that's a cool thing that's happening tomorrow. And if you're listening to this and feel like looking up to see what happened, I would recommend you do so.
Another great week of sports ahead. We are in full swing here in March and plenty to look forward to, but that will do it for this one. We'll see you folks on our regular scheduled time next week. But until then, I hope everyone has a fantastic weekend. And Max, I'll leave you to sign us off.
See everyone 3 days and 1 hour quicker than usual, if I have the math right. Until then, Sports Next Door, signing out. Get it, because it's daylight savings.
You get to the station, there's this crazy sound. Hey man, this ain't no fishing town. Yeah, they're fishing, that ain't all.